make sure you catch Teenage Bounty Hunters while you're on your vacation, because I watched it and it's great.
Teenage Bounty? Is it people hunting teenagers, or is it teenagers hunting other people? Butterscotch
Shenanigans. Hey everybody, welcome to episode 275 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I forgot the sequence of events. I'm Adam, and I forgot the sequence of events.
I'm Sam, and I respect the order, you know?
Yeah. Good job. This is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is September 4th, 2020. Mm. Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything could happen in this show. There's going to be swears. So deal with it. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. Thank you very much for letting us grab your money. And actually, I think it's September 3rd, so we're recording a day early, because Sam's gonna be scooting out and taking a nice, luxuriant four-day weekend.
Mm-hmm. We got that. You got to take advantage of when these natural events occur, where there's a long weekend, and then you just stack some extra days on the back of it. You know,
these natural long weekend events.
Mm-hmm. Such as, yeah, what is this one? I don't even remember what this one is. Labor Day. This is
Labor Day. I want to say Labor Day.
I think it's Labor Day. Yep. I don't even know what holiday it is.
Aren't you not supposed to wear white?
That's Memorial Day. No.
After the day, or maybe it's weddings. I don't know.
I'm
bad at holidays.
Basically anything about holidays. But all I know is that when they happen on a Monday, weddings, then you can sort of leverage that by using one of your, you know, vacay days on Friday. Not that I'm going anywhere,
yeah,
because, you know, there's a pandemic, but I will be vacating in my mind, you know, for a couple of days.
Yeah.
So you won't be doing any art or playing with spine or anything?
I will be doing a lot of that stuff, but I'll be doing it on my terms, Adam. You know? Yeah,
that's what I thought.
I'm always learning stuff. And
well, make sure you catch Teenage Bounty Hunters while you're on your vacation, because I watched it and it's great.
Teenage Bounty? Is it people hunting teenagers, or is it teenagers hunting other people?
It's a show about a couple of teenage girls who stumble into basically becoming sort of like interns for a bounty hunter, in secret, of course, because it's more dramatic that way.
Is it reality TV, or is it
no?
It's a show. Okay. I think my understanding of the world of bounty hunters in the United States as a thing is it's basically this wacky. It's just the Wild West. Like, there don't seem to be any actual laws. Like, you're somewhere. Like, we already know laws don't apply to police, right? But we have a structure in place, though, that like kind of pretends as if it does.
Pretends like there is.
So pretend like there are laws there that govern that institution. And then you have regular people for whom laws govern very, you know, very draconianly, right? And you got bounty hunters. Unless you're rich.
Yeah.
And then you got bounty hunters who are in the middle, this weird no man's land where we don't even pretend that law, like, laws don't apply, just period. We don't even pretend. And you just like get a license and you can just.
Do you even have to get
capture
license?
People now? I don't know. It's really wild.
You just capture people, yeah. And I guess in the premise of the show, they refer to the people they're catching as skips, which is typically people who have skipped out on court dates and are trying to flee or something.
Yeah,
And so they got to track them down, bring them back in, and then the state will pay, you know, whatever. So but I was telling my wife, it actually reminds me of The Walking Dead. But for a very specific reason. Like, The Walking Dead is a zombie show, right? And so you're like, fuck, there's going to be lots of zombie action. But in The Walking Dead, there's sometimes entire episodes where you never even see a zombie. Right. Because it's actually not about zombies. It's the zombies are like the background noise that injects chaos into the relationships between the characters, mm-hmm. right? So Teenage Bounty Hunters is very similar, where the bounty hunting is actually just kind of like a background thing that's kind of lurking there throughout the entire show, and it kind of rears up at random times to, you know, make the story more exciting. But it's a great show.
Is it really –
highly recommend.
Is it really actually about then the teenage – basically just being a teenager?
It's mostly just about teenagers just trying to figure out how –
coming of age story.
How to be people. It is, yeah. but also they're bounty hunters. Super good.
Can you be a teenage bounty? Because this is why I was curious. Like,
that's the thing. You can't.
There's at least one rule for bounty hunters, which you must be 18 or something.
Yeah, they made a point of it where, like, they aren't bounty hunters. They're just – they are interns for the guy who they ended up working with. So that was a legal loophole that they found.
You could be an intern for a bounty hunter, do bounty hunter activities, but not call yourself a bounty hunter.
Can you still just like capture people and, you know, just handcuff them and stuff? Or do you have to?
I don't know.
Do you have to be called a bounty hunter more officially? Can you be a bounty hunter intern and a 5-year-old and then handcuff people?
Sure.
It sounds and
probably
legit.
as long as your supervisor is there, right. You know, probably.
Right. That's true. Yep.
So Sam, you wanted to talk about Spiritfarer.
Yeah. So I picked this one up on Game Pass last weekend and settled in with it, and it's just absolutely lovely. So I wanted to pass the good word on to all of our listeners who might have either an Xbox or a PC. Actually, I think it's on everything, but it's via Game Pass as well for the subscription program, so you can just get it if you have that. But it's absolutely wonderful. So the whole idea is it's basically you become the ferryman for the underworld, and you're replacing Charon, who is the ferryman in, I think it's Greek mythology, who is like basically, you know, the Reaper. Like he looks like the Reaper in this context too. Big, bony, you know, he's got like a dark robe. He's very spooky looking. And then you're taking over, but you're this sort of like, oh, I guess you look like you're sort of like a maybe late teens, early 20s, very
maybe
a bright.
Teenage bounty hunter, maybe?
Yeah, who knows? You basically are a bounty hunter now. Think about it, because you go to these various, you're rowing a boat around in the afterlife, basically, visiting various islands and things. And you're finding these spirits who need to move on but haven't yet. And then you get them as passengers on your boat. You sort of help them resolve their final issues that are sort of tethering them to the world.
And you hug everybody.
And you hug everybody. And the thing is, like, the hugs are great. I'm going to be honest. Like, this is one of the few games where I was like, every time someone allowed me to hug them, I was just like, yes, because the animation's so good. it's all 2D traditional drawn animation. And especially the first
character. That means for every character they had, like, one of the things that they had to do was have a hug animation. Mm-hmm. But does your character also have a different hug for each?
I think you basically just go in the same.
You're in the same, right?
Yeah, but they sort of react however their personality is, right? But the hugs feel so good. So it's very cozy. It's just a really warm overall experience. And then beyond that, I think it ends up being a crafting game and a management game, right? So you're essentially managing this boat, you're building out stuff, you're collecting resources, you're doing like the typical activities. But they did a really just honestly like a phenomenal job of making it so that each one of those activities is different enough that you hardly feel like you're playing a game, is like sort of the easiest way I can put it, where it really like it does feel like you're just this person doing these things. But I think because of that range of activities where you can literally hug someone and then you go operate a sawmill, right, to like chop some lumber, and then you go out and like basically do some like light Metroidvania platforming things. And it's really good. And the writing's hilarious. Very fun. So
cat, which is probably the most important thing.
Yeah. And pro tip, if you press down and then the hug button, then you can hug your cat whenever you want. You can only hug people once a day. But yeah, the cat, I mean, you can hug that cat just constantly if you feel like it.
I guess the hugging people once a day rule makes sense, because if you kept trying to hug somebody repeatedly, they would be like, I'm out.
Yeah. I always try to hug them when I talk to them and they're like, I'm good. You know, I'm good. So I'm maybe good, someone actually. Else needs a hug. And I'm like, whew. The first time it happened, I was like, wow, okay. I guess there's boundaries in this game, but I wasn't here
for it. It's always a good thing to teach, physical boundaries. Yeah.
If you hug the cat too much, do you start to bleed?
I don't know. The cat's been very nice so far. Cat's a very funny secondary character.
Do you become wounded?
Yeah, I don't know.
Cool. So Spiritfarer, check that out. It's on, everything. Like I said, everything. Mm-hmm. And then we want to talk a little bit about some industry news before we get on to questions, which is Vlambeer announced that they are closing their studio after 10 years of making games. Mm-hmm. So Vlambeer, they were kind of at the forefront of the indie tsunami, I think would be the term. So they started, I think their first breakout game was Ridiculous Fishing.
Yeah,
Super Crate Box did super well for them, and then Ridiculous Fishing did ridiculously well for them.
Nice.
And around the time that they made Ridiculous Fishing, they were also in the middle of controversy because they had They had shown some stuff about ridiculous fishing, some gameplay clips and stuff before they had released it. And I think several other companies actually came and cloned it immediately, like in a week, and published clones of it, but long before the actual game came out. So they kind of got pushed into the forefront of this big conversation about just about like the cloning problem of that people were dealing with at the time, especially as new tools like Unity, Game Maker, whatever started becoming more robust and made it easier to just like quickly pump out a game.
You know, this is all sort of just happening at the same time.
So, and then they've made a bunch of great stuff since then, things like Nuclear Throne, and they've got was it Luftrausers,
the aerial dogfighting
game. So they made tons of cool stuff, and they were also very inspirational for us and a lot of other indies for their approach to things like Juice, you know, just like making super juicy, cool looking games.
Flambeer is known for their screen stuff. Shake and Juice, basically, like that's been their thing. Their titles tend to be more on the actiony and the arcadey side, and then with a lot of, they just feel good, you know, there's a lot of shaking of parts, there's a lot of explosions and that sort of thing.
And I'd say in the past several years, probably in the past 5 years especially, Rami Ismail, who's one half of Flambeer, spent a lot of his time touring around the world, giving talks at game developer conventions and events and stuff like that, talking about life as an indie developer, trying to give tips and help people out. They publish lots of tools to help other indie developers, but I would say that the core of their message over the years has sort of shifted from an optimistic tone to a more cautionary tone.
I think all of us have, you know.
To say, like, you know, at the beginning when there just weren't that many people making games, it was a blue ocean, as they call it, which is like there's plenty of room in the sea, you know, for everybody. The industry's great, the tools are great, there's a community that helped, that's very supportive and stuff. And if you have a dream, you know, you go build that thing and put it out, and you can make a living. And there were people, especially at the dawn of the iOS App Store and stuff, you know, there were people making a solitaire game and taking home $150,000 to $200,000, you know. Now there's $150,000 to $200,000 solitaire games. Yep. So it's not gonna happen.
Unless you do Solitaire Royale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So things have just gotten extremely competitive. The markets have opened up with things like Steam Direct, with the flood of things on Google Play and the App Store, and even previously sort of closed platforms, like Nintendo's eShop have seen a huge increase in the number of games that they have coming through and stuff like that. So things are just super competitive. And Flambeer, their kind of tone shift toward more like, well, be careful if you want to go into indie dev, because it's getting harder and harder all the time. And so the interesting thing about their closing announcement was essentially they just don't want to do it anymore, I guess. Like it's not a, oh, we ran out of money, oh, we're bankrupt, oh, our last project was a flop. It wasn't any of that stuff. They just said they just want to move on.
Well, yeah, it's at the moment it's unclear what that means, like moving on to, because both of them, so it's a two-person team, right? But both of them have been involved in just other kind of miscellaneous projects. They barely feel, at least from a public direction, like it's a team, right? It feels like you just have two different people who happen to fall under the banner of Flambeer on occasion, which is basically when a game comes out, right? Is really what it feels like.
I think that's largely been their shtick the whole time, though. If you read all these articles, because like they don't actually like each other, which is, I think, the funniest thing I've ever heard. I mean, they don't really like each other, but they know that they work extremely well together. Because
does that mean they dislike each other, or are they just like are indifferent?
I think they're largely either indifferent or leaning a little bit on the dislike side from all the stuff I've read and from chatting with Robbie himself.
But that's a hard relationship to maintain for 10 years.
Apparently not. I don't know. I think they seem like they had a good understanding of each other and the value that each other could bring to the partnership, and then just let that be what it was. So the programmer on that team has also done – he's been working on a bunch of projects actually. So Minute was actually programmed by the other half of Flambeer. And so it's one of those things where it doesn't seem like even that they're necessarily burned out, right? Which is sort of one read of it, because both of them are actually continuing to do stuff. It's more so just not under that.
Well, I think my bet is that, because the other thing that Rami's been doing for the past few years in particular, besides, so there's been a tonal shift definitely of like, okay, this is actually a lot harder and maybe you should consider not doing so on. But really the big thing he's been trying to do is make game development more accessible in the sort of in the community aspect where his whole thing is basically it's bullshit that all the major things take place first in the United States, because people from outside the United States, especially with the Trump presidency, can't get in to even attend conferences or speak at them and so on. And it's in San Francisco.
Yeah,
then even once you make it in here, now it's in one of the most expensive cities in the country and also the world, right? And so the accessibility, this is talking about like GDC and then also like PAXs and all these events, right? So all these events that are supposedly these are super essential business networking opportunities and places to learn from your fellow developers and all of this stuff. Because then you take like the GDC Vault, right, which costs like $1,000, $600 to get full access to. Mm-hmm. So the cost to entry to be a true part of the community and truly participate and have access to the same materials as everybody else and that kind of stuff is so high, even within the United States, but in particular if you have to come from outside, that it's just not accessible. It's just not available to huge swaths of the global population as well as the population inside the United States. And so his big thing has been advocacy for that, and basically publicly giving GDC a lot of shit for what they're doing. And then he also started that global online convention.
Yeah, Game Dev World.
Yeah, Game Dev World.
Yeah, their first one last year. It's basically it's actually speakers from actually across the whole globe. Then they give the talks in their native language. And mm-hmm. they are live closed captioned in like 10 other languages or something.
Yeah, I think actually most of what their funding goes to is to making things available in different languages. So in terms of it's all like professionally translated in the whole deal. So so he's doing very cool stuff. And that you can't do that and also run a game studio. There's just no way in hell you could do those two things. So my bet is that this other stuff that he's doing in terms of being a part of the industry is just going – he's going to be basically putting – instead of kind of pretending like he was doing both, because I think realistically it was probably
– it's hard.
It's just too hard, right? I think he's basically saying, okay, I'm actually done with the whole like being a person who makes games and sells games part and moving into this more like advocacy and potentially consultant role or something like that would be my bet.
Making the industry more so than the games at that point, right?
Yeah. Which is, I mean, I think honestly that's great for the industry because I think he's already been a really good influence on that direction and making that a little bit more official I think is probably – a good thing.
Yeah, so I think it's a big thanks to Vlambeer, I think, because they've been an inspiration for us as well as a lot of other industries, especially back in the day.
Got in 3 or 4 years before we started, right? So
yeah.
We always felt like we were trailing what they were doing and trailing the wave and getting to kind of see like what success looks like and what being a part of the industry looked like was largely in reference to them because they were also doing it so publicly. Mm-hmm. Compared to most other
studios. And with such a tiny team.
Yeah.
So best of luck to whatever they end up doing mm-hmm. in the future. I'm sure it'll be incredible. All right, well, let's get on to questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. The highest upvoted question comes from Irish Luck, who says, "What game do you go back to over and over again? For me, I always find myself playing Skyrim and RimWorld after trying something new."
Mm.
What's your comfort game, you know, that you just like – you just keep dipping back into
it? I have a few games that I always think I want to go back to, and then once I start, I like stop playing within an hour, which are Fallout 3 originally, but now Fallout 3 doesn't play well on Windows 10, which is hilarious to think that it's too – because it doesn't seem like it's that old of a game, but I think – the first time I played it was something like 10 years ago, so it must – it's old.
It came out in 2008.
Yeah, but yeah, it was – I know I played it several years after it came out, which was at least 10 years ago. So
yeah.
So yeah, it's actually an old game. But yeah, so it actually – it just doesn't run on Windows 10 anymore, it turns out. Mm. So I've tried to play it a few times, and if you set certain properties in some config file, you can get it to run like more or less okay, but every once in a while it'll just like freeze, and then it's just stop now. And so it's too tiresome. I think I probably would play that a little bit more if I could. But then there's also Fallout New Vegas, which I fucking love. So that one I might come back to. But the only one I actually come back to and like actually play for more than just an hour is probably Terraria.
Mm, yep.
And even that, it's only maybe a weekend, right? I'll play for 6 hours over a weekend or something.
Yeah.
So
I'm definitely a hobby gamer. So for me, it's just always been World of Warcraft, like since 2004.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's a totally different game every couple of years. I don't think that really counts because I'm not going back to it. And I did actually play the classic one for quite a while, but as happens with many MMOs, it's all about where your friends are, right?
Yeah.
And so most of my friends were still playing the current version, so I still play that one. But I do go back and I play RimWorld because it's amazing. Definitely, I would say the novelty of RimWorld does wear off over time, in the sense that like it's really crazy how in RimWorld pretty much anything can happen. And when you first start playing, it's these ridiculous stories come out of it, right? Where you're like, oh my God, this person was a pyromaniac and also horrifyingly ugly, and they kept getting rejected by everybody in the colony for romantic advances. And then they burned my entire food area down, and then everybody starved to death, right? It's like, that's a crazy story. But once you've played RimWorld for like 50 hours, you've seen stuff like that happen just all the time.
Yeah.
And it weirdly just becomes a matter of course, you know?
Right.
And so, but it's still amazing and it's great. And I haven't yet gotten to space. I haven't actually beat RimWorld. I've gotten super, super close. And then Kerbal Space Program, which is just amazing. And then Knights of the Old Republic.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The old, I think it was maybe 2003 something.
Yeah,
Xbox. Xbox Star Wars RPG game. I still submit that it's one of the best RPGs ever made.
Good.
And it's on Android, so you can get it for $5 to play on
that's
Android.
Crazy.
It plays medium because it's built for a controller. But you can also just use a Bluetooth controller with it. So yeah, I think I've played the first probably 10 hours of Knights of the Old Republic like 12, 15 times.
It's awesome that it has that level of variety, such that with a little time and a little forgetfulness, you can have a pretty fresh experience actually whenever you come back.
Yeah.
It actually you can
tell when you look at the stats for the characters and stuff like that it's from that era where RPGs were still heavily derived from the mechanics of Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
So your character still has like intelligence, constitution, wisdom, charisma, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So it's one of those ones where depending on what your character has, much like Fallout, right? Like different paths open up to you where you can persuade people, but then they have extra layers of stuff like force persuasion, you know, where once you become a Jedi, then you have like extra weird tricks that you can do to people depending on how you specialize. Yeah. So it's an amazing RPG.
Yeah, I think on my side, probably the one I've come back to the most in recent years is probably Terraria, and then Diablo 3, weirdly enough. That's just sort of one of the ones where every so often I'm like, I would just like to
slaughter monsters.
Just enjoy the loop, man. Just hop in the loop and just go. Diablo is great for that. Weirdly enough, especially since getting those subscription services, if I have just a couple hours of downtime, I've been mainly what I do is I just play a new one. It's made it so easy to kind of pop in, and it's been really fun because I think from a design sense, like I'm no longer looking for a particular comfort. What I'm looking for is just like something to inspect almost, which is actually where Spiritfarer came from last week. I played Undermine as well, which is pretty good roguelike. So yeah, I actually with the subscription services, it's more like I go back to the service, almost like Netflix, right? Like I don't rewatch shows. I've never done that really too much. I replay some of these games, but typically I try to do it in a different context when there's a new update or something like that. So for me, it's more about repeatedly having the experience of not knowing what the hell is going on at the beginning of a game is weirdly enough kind of the
that is the best.
Yeah.
Seeing what, not having any idea what's coming next. So There's some good recs, good recommendations. All right, let's go to the next question from Captain Jazz, who says, what is the important or interesting thing you have learned about yourselves, your team, and your studio during this season of working from home? Okay, this one's going to sound a little bit weird. Maybe no, maybe not.
Get weird.
I've discovered that a lot of my motivation for working out and lifting comes from knowing that other people will see me.
Yeah,
makes sense.
Seeing the same six people on video chat and essentially no other people, or at least people who I care about. If I just go to the grocery store or something, it's like whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Random strangers, whatever. But
you don't have to go intimidate anyone at GDC, for example.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, I don't need to be a big beef monster because nobody's going to see it. So what's the point? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
if we talked about
it, it shows the lifting wasn't really about being able to lift things. It was about being able to lift minds,
mm-hmm. Lift hearts, to flex into people's hearts. Yeah, no, I think that's very true. The one that's been surprising for me, one is actually how well it's all worked, to be honest. That was a big surprise. We talked about that a long time ago, but that was a very big surprise, especially given our last experience with it was when Adam was in Texas, and we were using a combination of Skype and Hangouts or something, and I don't know.
I think the tech wasn't as good at that time because that was
– Yeah.
Like Discord didn't exist yet. I think Discord is like one of the key reasons this is working. Slack probably was, but I think Slack as a means of recreating an office environment, I think is just not nearly as effective.
Yeah. So
it's still a good collaborative tool, but it's not good at like recreating an office.
Yeah. I think those things have been very, very surprising at the beginning. I think, for me personally, it's been that the degree to which, so like when you're in an office environment, it's very easy to basically derail anybody because you could just start talking to someone or if someone near you expresses anything, of like a high, with a high level of excitement, right? Whether it's like, oh my God, or like, what? Or, this sort of thing.
Yeah. Or somebody might just be reading an email and they'd be like,
Yeah.
And then you're thinking, oh, what? Was something that interesting. Yeah. Let me go jump over there.
I think I've been pleasantly surprised actually by, it's almost like the argument I used to have for the need to work in an office is also now the same argument I have for enjoying not working in an office, which is that when you're there, it's nice because you can basically there's this really open collaboration, and so you can get people's thoughts on X, Y, and Z. But it's also the case, of course, that you get collaboration where you just don't need it. Like I don't need someone to ask me like, why are you making that? Why are you being like, what? I wasn't saying it for you. It was just letting some emotional vents out and not having to actually sort of deal with that particular social layer has actually been very useful in terms of focus. What I will say in terms of my personal pride point for me in terms of the team is the extent to which, even though we don't then have that just sort of low level social interaction happening all the time, because of the two meeting structures, we start the day with the video chat, end the day with the video chat, and then some of these check-ins and like game days and stuff we've been doing, that it still feels like everybody on the team has really good rapport with each other. And I think because of the town hall structure and some of these other things we've implemented, everyone's still able to actually, I feel to emotionally connect with each other. And it seems like there's relationships there, as opposed to, I feel like one of the really rough things about work from home is that you can just get isolated, where it's literally just about doing the work, which I don't necessarily think is good over the long term.
I think that's true.
Yeah. Adam, you got anything?
I don't think I have anything to add to that. Really, I think I've largely been, I think the initial surprise was what we already said, which was just that it worked at all. But I think if we compare what we're doing now to what we were doing when I was working remotely from Dallas, to me, actually, it wasn't just the tooling. It was also, it was the mixed nature of it, because the thing that sucked about it the most was the sense that I was missing out on stuff, right? Because Sam and Seth would be working in the same space while I wasn't just like on audio video the whole time, like in the space. So that was just like also part of it, right? So I would get looped in when we had something to discuss, but that meant basically like when my specific opinion was needed, while Sam and Seth are of course just like talking back and forth basically constantly the whole time. And so there'd be all these,
that means the discussion has already happened.
Discussion's happening and now I'm being like filled in on a thing or whatever. And I think the way that we're working now is more structured anyway, because we have more people and it just sort of requires more of that, like, okay, these two people go off and actually figure stuff out and whatever. But when you're a three-person team and basically like two people are in the same room,
yeah,
hanging out, having a good time, drinking Red Bulls, eating chocolate, and like, and then, yeah. and then oh, yeah. coming up with and solving interesting problems, like playtesting yeah. and having telling jokes. And get the whole thing right, and then you're off literally by yourself. Because at the time too, my wife was still not working inside the home, and so she's gone. Right, so I'm just like at home by myself in silence. And then would sort of like be introduced to interesting things that I'd missed. Right.
Right.
Which is just deeply unpleasant. And then you do that for like, and I did that for a year and a half. It's just not good. And that made me have a really just bad view about what remote working would be like. And now having thought about that, once we moved into this, I was thinking back to, mm-hmm. to what it meant and what the differences were and how do we not recreate those same problems that I had to deal with. And for me, actually the crux of it was to not have a mixed or to minimize the mixed model aspect of it where you have partially remote, partially local. I feel like that's where the conflicts really start to come in, and you have to then, which isn't to say it's impossible, but you have to really just explicitly tackle that problem and say, if we're going to have a mixed model where some people are remote and some people are not, then what does that mean? How do we, mm-hmm. what level of participation do we need our remote people to be for this work situation to work, and then make sure you actually do it. Because if you just start doing it and you're just like, okay, well, whatever, we got remote people, we got local people are talking, having a great time doing their own thing, and then the remote people are just missing out on everything, it just doesn't work. It just sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I will also say that it's made me question having a vehicle. You know, Sam,
I sold
your car.
Yep.
I mean, we're going out of the house a couple times a week to take our dog to daycare, where we basically just at range sort of like set her loose into the daycare. And then once every like 7 weeks, you know, we pay for another package of days or whatever. So very – almost no human interaction there, mm-hmm. which is, you know, weirdly ideal at this point in time. But other than that, you know, just not going places. But I don't want to be caught in that situation where in the aftertime, you know, once this is all done, I don't have to go get a car because that's going to be a
pain. I think the main thing for me is that I'm in the same boat. I don't go anywhere, but I really like drink because I have a little manual Ford Focus with like no features. You know, I do have power windows and air conditioning at least, but it's a feature free vehicle and getting to just like hop into a tiny car.
It's like a go-kart.
Have the manual shifting mm-hmm. experience. And now it makes driving so satisfying because normally I'm bored out of my mind when I'm driving. I hate having to go places.
Also, you don't even have cruise control.
Don't even have cruise control. I think it's a piece of driving that gets to make it actually be fun versus driving my wife's car, which is just a more normal vehicle. And there's something about the ease of doing it that then just adds to my boredom, right? Where I'm like, oh, I got to go somewhere. Now it's so boring to go to that place because like, I'm just pressing a pedal down and the car's.
Yeah,
just,
that you know, is something that's going to, I mean, with electric cars.
Yeah, it's going to get even worse. I mean, yeah.
yeah. Manuals are already dying. Yeah. They're pretty much dead at this point. I think what's the I don't remember what the statistics are, but there's it's now like single digit percentages of Americans know how to drive a stick
shift. I mean, my car was because I was trying to get it as cheap as possible, you know, by knocking off cruise control and knocking off automatic, which often goes hand in hand. You can have cruise control with a manual, but that's a weirder thing. I saved 15% of the car's cost otherwise would have been by knocking mm-hmm. those two things off, you know.
And it's more fun to drive.
I'm in this kind of weird position where like we don't need two cars. My car is clearly the more useless of the two. My wife can't drive it. It's too small to store things. So like if we need to ever go do a real like mission of some sort, it's got to be my wife's car. So I keep on having this conflict where I'm like, I don't really need this thing. We're not going to go back to office life. Even post-COVID. And post-COVID, we're talking, you know, a year and a half or more down the road. So it's still, even if we do go back to the office, it's so far away. But cars depreciate in value so fucking fast, right? That mm-hmm. if I sell this car now, then I'm basically what I'm saving money on is now car insurance, right, for the next
few years. Insurance
property. But if I decide I need a car within like literally a decade, I think, I haven't saved any money because now I'm going to get a car again. And the value of these things is so –
Yeah, you should just keep that little manual Ford Focus and just grind it into.
That was my original plan. I've already been driving it. It's a 2009, right? So I've been driving it for a long time, and my plan was to drive it until it just literally wouldn't work. And then, because at that time the value, I think the value, like for me to sell it now between then is probably almost the same.
If right now it's Blue Book value right now is like $1,500 or something. It's like you're just running out of places to depreciate to.
Exactly. Yeah, it can't. It was not going to go down to zero. So I think I'm at the bottom of that curve, and so I might as well just like keep this thing going forever. So I think looking at the financial part, like it actually, I don't think. If it's likely in the next decade that I'm going to need a car, then it just doesn't make sense to sell the one I have. That's kind of where I've landed. But it would, on the other hand, be kind of nice to not have another expensive asset to worry about. But again, it's not actually expensive anymore because it's not fucking worth anything because, you know, it's an old car. Nobody's going to want it.
Yeah, probably most of your insurance is on liability, I assume. Car is totaled if it gets even like a dent on the bumper.
Yes.
Because the cost to repair was more than the value. Probably would be, yeah. Because I've been fortunate in the sense that I've lost two cars to hailstorms while I wasn't in them, which is, you know, and also where I managed to get more money from the insurance definitely than I could have sold the car for.
Yep.
So I got a little refresher, you know, a couple of times. We haven't had any terrible hailstorms like that since then.
Knock on wood, man.
Also, Sam, I had a weird moment when you were talking about Diablo 3, when you were like, oh, yeah, that's like one of my comfort games that I keep going back to. And I'm thinking, shit, that game came out 8 years ago.
Yeah.
It did. But Diablo 3, because I distinctly remember, it didn't feel like that long ago. I remember looking forward to the launch of Diablo 3 and being super pumped, and then like the crazy server issues they were having and – but it also occurred to me, I was chatting with Sampy yesterday about how I'm almost to the point where more than half of my life will have been spent post high school graduation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that's a significant benchmark to think, you know, more than 18 years ago you graduated from high school. It seems like that's a long time.
Yeah. I think the weird thing too about the COVID stuff is that it's just how fast time goes when your routines are more strict than they used to be, even. Because again, when we were working in the office, we had the same routine every day, right? But you know, driving to the office, work, and then basically be done with working. But I think the difference in the evenings, whether it was like, oh, I'm gonna go to the gym or go see a friend before I head home or whatever else, there's a lot more running around, a lot more events and stuff. And so part of it is basically there's a memory density thing, which is that when it comes to making like new, brand new memories that have like a higher emotional kind of gain to them. For me, the pandemic has been interesting in that same sort of weird time slippage way where, cause like it's September somehow. And I think that's the feeling that just keeps creeping up. And the thing is, like, you know, whenever we've talked to our parents about this stuff, there's always that comment. I'm sure people have had this experience too, where people who are – anyone who's older than you will typically say something like, oh, yeah, make sure you pay attention because, like, it'll go by real fast. Like, anything that's happening to you will seem like it's just – now it's a year later, right? And it only accelerates as time goes on. But yeah. It also accelerates depending on how structured your routines are, how regular they are.
Oh, yeah. I think it's absence of efficiency is what – It's like that Adam Sandler movie with the remote control.
Right? Click.
It's like, right. Click, right. But yeah, it's the as things become more routine and become more efficient, because that's kind of the same thing, right? Because I think even with the office stuff, because I think the office environment too actually slowed down time. Because sure, within an environment we had, there was still, you know, an order of things that happened. We were still collaborating in a similar way that we are now. But there was more inefficiency in the system, because now if you wanted to sit down and work with somebody, you had to like go find a place to do it so that you weren't bothering other people. Mm-hmm. When you wanted to have lunch, you didn't just like walk downstairs and prepare a meal with your spouse and eat that or whatever. You had to be like, oh, okay, I'm going to go like run down and see if I can scrounge up something real fast. This is how I ate, right? Scrounge up something real fast. And you go down and you get coffee. There's a random number of people online. Like, and there's
chat with someone. Yeah.
You chat with somebody, you have like, or in my case, because I'm an introvert, like weird just social things where I'm like trying to decide if I should or should not chat with people, right? But those things, there's none of that stuff that's happening anymore. And so you see the same, you know, person in, like in your own house, right? And you have a routine there. They have a routine probably. And it's the same sort of thing. Like the people in your household, if you have more than one, are doing the same thing, right? They have also, if they're working from home, they've got the same sort of like isolated nature. They don't have the same, they've got their own schedule now going on. So they also don't have chaos going into their lives, which creates, mm-hmm. so they don't, because normally chaos spreads, right?
Chaos creates memories.
Yeah, it creates more chaos. So if your roommate or significant other or whatever, you know, comes home from work and is like, oh, here's the mountain of interesting, weird surprises that happened to me at work today, yep. because it's a chaos engine, that creates chaos for you. And then you have a thing to talk about and so on, you know, but yeah, once you take all that stuff away, you're just like, you're just a work machine. You're a working and living machine on a routine, right? So yeah, it changes things.
Yeah, it's been wild because as we record the podcast, I mean, it's ever since we went to work, switched to work from home, it's been so hard to come up with stuff that has happened. Like we always had like the life section, right? And I don't think it's actually about working from home. It's about working from home and also not going anywhere.
Yeah. It's the pandemic more so than anything else, right?
Yeah. So, you know, we have things to talk about, like Netflix shows that we saw and stuff, but
well, especially when like because otherwise the stuff that we are doing on a daily basis is just getting real in the weeds on stuff, because that's what jobs are, right? Jobs are being in the weeds on stuff. And that's not a thing to talk about on the podcast. So we'd sit down and we're like, okay, what happened this week? And then we're like, okay, this really cool thing happened with us trying to make this prototype, and like this, we just learned this cool web thing. And there's like a long list of interesting things, just not for this, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's no longer the chaos engine producing things that are of sort of general interest to people.
There's a difference between a story and like a lecture. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is a storytelling podcast, not a lecture podcast.
Yeah. So it's been different. So just say that.
Maybe that means we need to just have embraced this problem, just as acknowledge it as a problem, and have because the chaos that comes in the podcast comes from listener questions, right?
Correct.
Which in the past we would spend so much time actually talking about stuff that wasn't questions that we'd always end up with like doing one in the last 10 minutes or something. So far, I think we've only hit one, but for the past 20 minutes or whatever. So, but by actually just having the podcast seeded more intensely with questions, then. Just use that as the chaos engine and not worry about it.
Yeah, I'd like to thank our podcast listeners for being the agents of chaos in our lives during the pandemic, you know?
Yep.
Maybe you need an app on your phone called Chaos Engine, and you tell it all the things that you plan to do, you know, that day.
Right. And have it randomly stop you in some way.
Or it'll just randomly shuffle them, you know? So you'll be like, fuck, I guess I got to eat dinner, even though it's 9:30 in the morning.
The kind of chaos you need is not the chaos where like, look, it's, you don't need literal chaos, right? You need a plan that gets contravened in some way, right? Mm-hmm. You need something to happen. You need to have an intention. And as you're going to do that, something has to get in the way. So what you need is the chaos engine needs to be a thing where you are about to do a thing and then you randomly roll to see if something bad happens to you in the process or good.
So you need sort of a D&D situation.
Exactly, you need a D&D situation.
Yeah. So you guys make fun of my precarious situation setups that I'm always living. But
this is
how I stay alive. Yeah. So this morning, for example, so my wife and I got scones, of course. And then I had this little scone box and I had a hot drink in one hand and a cold drink in the other because I got to have like all of the drinks when I'm coming.
You know, if you put your hands in both of those, you just pee.
But it's true. That's why
I don't want anything from high school or from
middle school. Well, it's true. Yeah. I don't want to end up just peeing all over the place. So, you know, I got to keep these separate, far apart. But this means then I can't carry the scone box, which has half a scone in it, upstairs. So I precariously.
Did you wrench this?
No. I precariously just balanced it on top of one of the cups. And I turned to my wife as I started heading upstairs and I was like, nothing could go wrong. And then I just started going up. Because, like, what? Who cares? If a scone gets thrown on the ground or I pour some tea on the floor, like, who gives a shit? It'll be more interesting as I head upstairs in the first place. So,
but I guess, also, nothing went wrong, which is why you almost didn't tell us that story until we had to talk about the context of things not going wrong.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yep. Nothing happened.
Yeah, because that's certainly, right. It's interesting in this context because we're talking about it. But had you just told that story without any other context, that would have been just a boring fucking story.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Being like, hey, I balanced something on a cup today and nothing went wrong.
Nothing went wrong. Yeah,
wow,
the end.
They clap for you.
Although we could celebrate small victories, you know, where it's like, I put myself in this precarious situation and everything went great because you know, it's one of those, we used to talk about this back in my science days, right? Is like, is everything you read is basically we discovered this thing that we think is true, right? Mm-hmm. And then nobody's interested in hearing the thing that you found was not true. And so you just don't get to put that out there. And so you end up with this crazy survivorship bias where it looks like everyone's got their shit. It's like Instagram. Everyone's got their shit together.
Yep.
You don't somehow you're the only one, right? And it's the same deal here. It's like we're putting ourselves in situations all the time where things end up actually working out okay, right? We wouldn't talk about that because it's not interesting, right? So maybe we need to talk about these boring things a little bit more just to be like, you know, life is a humdrum thing where you can sow some attempted chaos. And sometimes you don't get that chaos. Sometimes it doesn't pay off. Sometimes you don't have to clean up a spill, you know, but we can talk about that too.
Yeah,
there needs to be a scientific journal just called False, which is
things
where
they'll
just anytime you had a finding where you thought something was going to be true and it turned out not to be true, then it just they'll just
yeah. There was a joke of like a fake journal name that people would reference. I can't remember. There was some like joke name that people would use when they would talk about, but it was when they were dismissing a thing and being like, well, you can't publish that because the only place you can publish it is the journal of water, right? Which doesn't exist. And there have actually been some efforts for like online journals and stuff to create some. Oh, it was the Journal of Negative Results. That was the one.
But I think, I mean, that's so useful though. I mean, when we're Googling around to try to solve one of our weird tech problems, like finding a forum where someone's like, hey, I tried this and it didn't work is usually how you get to the point where you figure out what does work. So I think it's zany to me that the whole science community doesn't have that equivalent aside from
of a department. Yeah, you just have to try to find a way to frame it in a discovery sense. That's always the goal. It's like we discovered this, which is in direct contradiction, you know, whatever. But like you have to find a way to twist it so that people feel like you have achieved something instead of because there's something about that there's just a bias against the idea of discovering that a thing is not true. In particular, if nobody else thought that it was true previously, which makes sense, right? Because if you go out there and there's something that people claim about the world and you do your experiments, you're like, this isn't true. Like this thing is wrong. It's already really hard to publish that. If you just have your own idea, right? You're like, I think the world works in this way. And there's nothing out there to contradict that. So it's a viable thing, right? You go do the experiments. You discover, shit, the world does not work this way. And not only that, but the thing that I discovered is actually so boring like about that fact that I can't find a way to – I didn't discover something. I just had an idea that turned out to be false, right? That's where your little scenario is, where you can have a really great, really interesting, viable idea based – like, and as far as you can tell, based on what everybody else knows, that this is potentially true. And if you just discover that it's false, nobody gives a fuck. And there's no way to get that knowledge out there. And I think that's the place we don't have that.
Well, there needs to be an organization. I don't know what they would be called, but like they're like knights or crusaders or some kind of like they go out there and they hunt down hypotheses that everybody agrees upon and they just aggressively dismantle it. You know, and disprove.
Well, it is a lot of what academics is supposed to be, right? Is basically your whole community is supposed to be that, and that does work to an extent. But the apparatus around it, because the people want to do that, but the apparatus around it in terms of getting funding and getting published, that kind of stuff doesn't support it.
Well, that's the problem. Is it's not. Imagine how the world at large would view the group of people who constantly shoot down every new scientific discovery.
I mean, that is what scientists – yeah, that's usually what they do, right? I mean, most major theories, first time they're put out, everyone's like, pah! And then like 30 years later, everyone's like, yeah, they were right, I guess.
You know? Actually, no, they're usually like, oh, that was totally wrong still. But we thought it was right for a while.
Yeah, right.
But it probably wasn't.
All right. Next question comes from a couple of people. It's about the new Game Maker update, Game Maker 2.3. So a question from Mopate Flatunk says, oh, Game Maker released a new version with structs and functions. How quickly, if at all, do you adopt the new functionality? Do changes to your core technologies like this excite you or cause you anxiety and dread? And Retro Banana Man NL says, I see Game Maker Studio 2 has a new patch. What's your experience with it? I assume you had fancy beta access. So it's incredible. It is a game changer in terms of what is now possible in like on the programming side. However, we have a tooling issue which is this new version of GameMaker, completely changes how GameMaker projects are structured. And all of the tools that we've built to assist in our development rely on the original version of GameMaker projects. So none of our current tools will work. And we also – so back when we started working on Levelhead, we had not migrated our older games to GameMaker 2.2, which is the current version. And it was a very slow process that ended up creating a huge amount of tech debt. And as you may know from listening to our more recent episodes, it took us about 3 months of aggressive work to dig out of the tech debt hole that we created for ourselves because we hadn't deliberately migrated those games to the new version. So, of course, right as we get finished with this round of tech debt burned down, the next version appears. And so our plan is now we need to try to orchestrate this better so that we can actually just migrate all the games at once. Mm-hmm. And once we have our tools up to date, then we make the switch.
Yeah. So we're both very excited. So basically all the things that you asked if we were feeling that emotion, the answer is just yes.
Yep. Yes. Excited and filled with anxiety and dread? Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff. I think the thing to me that's going to be really – I think the biggest thing that's a change that's going to be extremely valuable is the ability to just define functions wherever you want. And because it's a code reuse thing, right? In GameMaker, you can't easily reuse code because you have to put that reusable code in the global scope, right? So if you want a function that you can call twice – now everything can call that function, every fucking thing in the whole program. And so now you have this like huge wall of scripts and it's all organized. Like, so I don't even know how many we have in like Levelhead, right? But it's a jillion, but you don't need them for almost anything you're doing ever, right? So you don't get access. It's like the amount of just mental overhead required to make large scale games in GameMaker is enormous. And they're going to cut down a lot on that.
Yeah, I think just to kind of give a sense of what it means is it's the idea like let's say you have a pause menu in your game, and the pause menu is going to do a bunch of stuff, right? It's going to spawn some buttons. It's going to maybe like pause the world and deactivate things, whatever. And all of these different verbs that the pause menu is doing, those are what you would consider a function, right? It's just like a thing that it's going to do. So previously your options were either you just code those up in the pause menu, just in raw code. So instead of making an encapsulated function, you just write out all the stuff that it's going to do. Or you make a script, which then goes into the project hierarchy in your pile of your other 3,000 scripts. And as Adam said, now anything can use that function. Mm-hmm. So I could have a function called like pause menu spawn buttons. And I could use that script in the player object or on the main menu, even if there is no pause menu and presumably nothing would happen. But that's confusing, right? Like, why can I do that? I shouldn't be able to.
Something might happen. If something did happen, you wouldn't want it to, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the nice thing with this update is now I can create a function that lives in the pause menu object that it's just part of that object. And so it doesn't appear anywhere else in the game. Nothing else is going to use that function.
Yeah, I mean, any programmers listening to this who are programmers and have not used GameMaker, you'll be hearing this and you'll just be thinking, oh my God, like that was that was what – yeah, it's a wild – there are a few just like core deficiencies in pre-2.3 GameMaker. That made it just honestly extremely difficult to program large-scale projects. We did it anyway, and a lot of that was through also having external tooling, as well as just developing approaches to doing it that kind of kept stuff relatively safe and like reasonable to manage. But it required just a lot of our own overhead to be able to do, and that's going to go away. And then and that's going to bring with it some additional cool stuff that's going to make it easier to handle asynchronous things, meaning I ask for a thing to happen, and I don't know when it will happen, right?
Like web stuff,
web stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So you never know when a web request is going to come back, and you want to make sure you can still do stuff between now and then, if you need to, right? And that when the thing does come back, then you know that it did, and you can do something about it. And coding up that logic in GameMaker 2.2 and below is like if you look at just the code involved with handling the rumpus web requests, it is something. It is just, I don't even know how many objects and global scripts are involved, but that's a lot.
Numerous.
it's a whole bunch of stuff. Like me coming from JavaScript and Node, I'm just so spoiled on this stuff where like the kind of stuff that Seth has had to do to make these things work is stuff that he's done in like 1,000 lines of code or things that I can do in like 10, right? And it's just because of these, like, these core missing sort of components of the language. So I'm very excited for just how much programming capacity is going to be added by this update. And even though we're going to rebuild all of our tools, which I just finished actually rebuilding as well, we're going to rebuild them all, but the underlying structure of the GameMaker projects now is way less wild.
Yeah, it's better.
A lot better. It sucks that I have to redo the work, but the thing that made it hard the first time was, you know, we're externally managing the files that GameMaker makes and then doing that in such a way that we don't break your project. Like, that's the goal, right? And so GameMaker just does stuff in such weird, idiosyncratic ways. Like, you can't, if you make a thing work for sprites, it won't also work for sounds, right? And that's including how folders are managed and stuff. Like, just stuff that should be the same everywhere, they're just not the same. And I won't go into the weeds about the other stuff, but I'll just say that folder management, like the way that GameMaker handles folders, is you couldn't guess that this is how that they are. It is wild. But GameMaker 2.3 does like what you'd expect, basically makes it a lot more reasonable. So if you look at the code for the tooling that we've put together so far, I think fully like a third of all of the code is dealing with folders, right? Because the way it's handled is so weird and so logically convoluted that it just required this huge amount of infrastructure. So yeah, I mean, it's all to say, I think this is only a good thing, but it's going to create some nuisances for us, definitely.
Yeah, there's also some really good artist style side updates coming in.
Oh, yeah.
The sequencing system, which basically allows you to actually animate from within. It's, I guess, more or less animate UIs or animate cutscenes and stuff like that from within GameMaker itself, which is huge, because then as the artist side of things, you can, one is that work previously always had to go onto the programming team. So yeah, you could scope something out to your heart's content, but you couldn't actually get it in there yourself. And now it's more so that the programmers, how it should be basically, which is the programming side of things sets things up, and then you go and iterate on the delivery of those things, the animations of those things, until they're actually good. And so a lot of the art side is going to be changing too, such that I think teams that are a bit more professional or trying to leverage into a more professional status with GameMaker as an engine will have a much easier time going forward. We should be good.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, and I also want to give a shout out to the Yo-Yo Games team. We know a number of the folks on the engineering team and product development team and stuff, and they've been working their buns off to get this, because we've seen little glimpses of some of these things even up to like 3 years ago as they were trying to, because I mean this GameMaker was originally made by just a guy in the early 2000s, I think, and it has evolved over time to go from something that could make standalone Windows executables, period, where the programming editor was essentially Notepad with literally no syntax highlighting, no variable memory, nothing. They have managed to sort of shepherd this piece of software and evolve it over time into something that's becoming just increasingly more and more powerful. And they've done a great job with it. Mm-hmm. So very excited about GameMaker 2.3. Now's as good a time as any, you know, to pick up a new hobby. If you're interested in game dev, check it out. Check out GameMaker 2.3. You know, you might have some time because of the situation. Yep. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Coster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the community Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the podcast archives. Thank you all for listening. See you next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.